You're listening to the Lululemon Speaker Series podcast. I'm Juma from Leadership Development.
And I'm Audrey from Internal Communications. Thank you for joining us.
Today, we're super lucky to have with us Kim Scott, the author of the New York Times bestseller, Radical Candor.
The very best conversations, and in fact, for me, the origin story of Radical Candor, happened in the space of time it took a light to change on the streets of Manhattan. I had just gotten this golden retriever puppy, Belvedere, and I loved Belvedere so much that I had never said a cross word to her. So, and she was totally out of control. So I'm walking her along the street, and she jumps in front of a cab, almost gets killed. I pull her out of the way just in time, and this man, a perfect stranger, looks at me, and he says, "I can see you really love that dog." It's all he has to do to move up on care personally. He doesn't have to remember my birthday or take me out to lunch or spend, "I can see you really love that dog, but," he says to me, "you're gonna kill that dog if you don't teach her to sit." And then he points at the ground in this kind of harsh gesture and he says, "Sit." Dog sat. I had no idea the dog even knew what that meant. And I kind of look at this guy in amazement and he says to me, "It's not mean, it's clear." And then the light changed and he walked off, leaving me with words to live by.
Just a little taste of what we heard earlier today from Kim Scott. And now we're psyched to share some of the insights from her talk with you and to ask her some questions about how to use radical candor to improve communication in the workplace.
Thank you so much. It's awesome to be here.
So Kim, you have an impressive professional track record.
Thank you.
The reason you're here today is because you're CEO and co-founder of Radical Candor LLC, within which you wrote a book, which we'll learn about in a moment. You've been an executive at Google, at Apple. You talk about these characters, Cheryl and Larry, in your book, which many of us have heard about. You have been an advisor at Dropbox, Twitter, several other big tech companies. You were a member of the faculty at Apple University, led a course, which was really about being a really great boss. And before that, you led AdSense, YouTube, and DoubleClick online sales and operations at Google.
I did. I have a hard time staying in one place.
Yeah, let me see if I can keep rolling. Not to mention that earlier in your career, you worked as a policy advisor at the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC.
I did.
You managed a pediatric clinic in Kosovo.
That was my favorite.
Started a diamond cutting factory in Moscow.
In Moscow, right? I did, yes.
An analyst on the Soviet Companies Fund.
I was that too.
Let's keep rolling with this.
I'm a very old lady.
You're the author of three other books, Virtual Love, The House Husband, and The Measurement Problem. And you and your husband, Andy, have twins and live in San Francisco. Is that right?
We do have twins. You got it. We live in Los Altos,
okay.
Not San Francisco.
Have we missed anything else?
No, you got it all. You got it all.
Obviously, Kim, you are a very busy person, and I'm wondering how important good communication is in your life personally.
Good communication is really at the heart of everything. I would not have fun with my children if I couldn't communicate with them. I wouldn't have a happy marriage if I couldn't communicate with my husband, and I wouldn't be able to get stuff done if I couldn't communicate with my colleagues at work. And a lot of the principles that I've learned at work have helped me out a lot at home and vice versa.
I mean, communication is tricky under any conditions, but especially in a work environment.
Yes.
So can you just talk a little bit about the challenges of communication, real communication at work?
I think that if we're to boil it up to the very highest level, there's two problems. One is love and the other is truth. So let's try to take it down from such a high level. Part of the problem, I think, is that from the time we get our first job, we're right around the time when we're 18, 19, 20 years old, and someone will come along and say to us, "Be professional." And we're right at that moment in our lives when our egos are maximally fragile and our personas are beginning to solidify. And when somebody says, "Be professional," to us at that moment, for a lot of people, it means leave your emotions, leave your true identity, leave your humanity, leave everything that's best about you at home and come to work like some kind of robot. And you can't possibly communicate well if you're just a robot. You can't possibly build real relationships at work if you're showing up like some kind of robot. So that's kind of the love part of radical candor. And then the truth part, I think the problem here actually begins not when we're 18 years old, but when we're 18 months old. How many of you listeners had a parent, just raise your hand, even if you're driving safely, raise one hand, who said to you some version of, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And the problem is now you're at work and congratulations, it's your job to say it. And this is really hard. It's hard to undo training that's been pounded into our heads since we got our first job at 18 years old and since we learned to speak at 18 months old.
Love and truth. So simple.
You've got to do both in order to communicate well.
Yeah. Well, truth be told, I love that.
Perfect.
So your talk here at Lululemon was all about radical candor. That's the methodology you developed for improving workplace communication for managers and employees. And it's also the name of your best-selling book, which is part of our core library.
Yes.
Here at Lululemon. So I want to start by asking you to explain what the theory is all about. So if you can break it down for us and even tell us what is so radical about candor.
Yes. Why is it called radical candor? Mm-hmm. I think the reason why I call it radical candor is it is so rare. It's so rare that people will tell us what they really think in a way that shows us that they care about us. And yet it is so fundamental to good communication. So that's why I call it radical candor. It's rare and it's very fundamental. And again, the idea comes really, if you take a step back and you think about what a leader's job is, at the very core, we're going to talk about it in terms of concentric circles. At the very core of what a leader's job is themselves, self-care. You've got to make sure that you're leading yourself, that you're doing the things you need to do to take care of yourself. And then the next concentric circle is the relationships that you form with the people who you work with. Not just employees. I'm not talking about it in a strictly hierarchical form, but with your peers, with your managers, with anyone who you work with customers. So those relationships are really important. And then the next concentric circle is your responsibilities. And one of your responsibilities, I think, is to contribute to a culture of feedback, to really make sure that you're communicating well and encouraging good communication with the people who you're collaborating with. And then another part of your responsibility is to be part of a team, to help a team contribute to being cohesive in a way that allows 10 people to achieve what no one person could even dream of, and for 10 people to be able to sort of multiply one another and have the impact of 20. That's the excitement of being on a team. And finally, of course, you want to achieve some results. And you can't do those things. You can't possibly give feedback to other people in order to achieve results if you don't have good relationships. So relationships are very much at the core. Now, of course, relationships don't scale. Nobody can have more than a few relationships. Relationships take a lot of time, demand a lot of time, and deserve a lot of time. But culture scales. And when sort of culture emerges from the way that you conduct your relationships in order to fulfill your responsibilities, that's what does scale, that culture that comes out of that virtuous, or it can be vicious, unfortunately, sometimes cycle. When you get it wrong, it's vicious. When you get it right, it's really virtuous.
There's so much of this that is so aligned to our culture and our practices of leadership. And we say here that a culture of feedback really is fundamental to how people lead and how people develop.
Yes.
And you've developed a methodology, seven-step methodology: listen, clarify, debate, decide, persuade, execute, learn. I wonder if you can unpack those stages a bit in the context of what you just shared.
Sure. That's what I call the get stuff done wheel, or you can use some other word than stuff if you want to. And the idea is that it's very tempting when you want to get something done to jump into executing. But if you're working with other people, and even if you're working all alone, I learned this writing a book, which I thought was the ultimate solitary endeavor, and it turns out it's highly collaborative. In fact, I think I had 115 collaborators at one point on the Google Doc I used to write Radical Candor. So you want to start by listening. That's your point of departure. And understanding what the ideas of the people you're collaborating with are. And then you want to take some time to clarify those ideas, because new ideas are fragile and they're so easily just squished. And the next thing that we're going to talk about is debate. But before you submit people's ideas or your own ideas to the rough and tumble of debate, you really want to make sure that you're taking the time not only to listen, but to clarify, help others clarify their ideas, to make those ideas easy enough to understand and robust enough that they will survive the rough and tumble of debate. And the important thing next is, once you've clarified the idea, is to take time to get more people's opinions on that idea, to get more feedback on that idea. One of the things that I really enjoyed working at Apple was the comparison of debate on a team to a rock tumbler. Steve Jobs had a story where he said, as a kid, he went over to his neighbor's house, and the neighbor said, go out into the yard, get some ordinary stones, and we're going to throw them into this tin can kind of contraption, and turned on the motor. And he said, come back in 2 days. Steve went back in 2 days, and the neighbor pulled out the stones from the rock tumbler, and they were these beautiful, polished stones. He couldn't believe what a difference it made. And he said, debate on a team is kind of like a rock tumbler. There's a lot of noise, a lot of friction, but as long as you eventually turn the tin can off so you don't have just a bunch of dust in there, that's what actually polishes ideas and also polishes us as human beings. We really learn a lot from debating with one another, but it can be painful, especially in this world where people have beliefs that others not only don't share, but find repugnant. So what's the point of having all these debates and talking about belief? And I think often you're not going to change someone else's belief, but by being willing to really debate a belief or it could be an idea about a fabric. It doesn't have to be a deeply held belief, but either way, even if you don't persuade that other person, you do clarify your own thinking. You improve your own thinking and you improve the thinking of those around you. So there's a lot of benefit to having the debate that goes beyond changing another person's mind. That's not the goal of a debate, to change someone else's mind. The goal is to learn together. So now you've gone through this process. You've listened to other people's ideas. You've helped them clarify them. You've subjected them to the rough and tumble of debate. Now it's time to make a decision, right? You can't debate endlessly. And it's so important to push decisions into the facts. We as human beings want to be the decider. And it's so important to make the best decisions, to let go of the desire to control decisions and to push decisions to the people who are best able to make them. Push decisions into the facts. And to be clear, a group of people collaborating to achieve a result needs to be really clear who the decider is and by when the decision needs to get made. And if the decider is always the person who's most senior in a hierarchy, then that person is not being a good leader. That person should not be the decider most of the time. You want to build decision-making on the team. So now this has been an exhausting and time-consuming process. Now you've listened, you've clarified, you've debated, you've decided. It's tempting now to jump straight to execution, but there's still another step before you can start executing. And that is persuading, because not everyone in an organization will have gone through all these steps. And so you've got to share the context of the decision. You've got to share the rationale for the decision. But you also have to be willing to take into account other people's emotions around this decision that has been made. In order to persuade others that a good decision has been made, you need to establish the credibility of the decider. You need to share the logic, but you also need to address the emotions. Very often, we'll make a decision as an organization, and about a third of the people will really be hurt by the decision. And pretending that that's not the case is not going to help. So one fun example, again, from Apple is when Steve Jobs decided to launch iTunes on the Windows platform. he didn't announce it only sharing the logic. I mean, it was the logic was pretty unassailable. But he also understood that a lot of the Mac faithful would feel this was a betrayal. And so the way he launched it was with the campaign, "Hell Froze Over." So he addressed the emotions when he made this decision. And in fact, he himself had been opposed to making that decision, which is interesting, but that's a whole other story. So now, finally, you're ready to execute. The steps that you have just gone through are sort of a collaboration tax. And it's really important to make sure when you're collaborating with others that you and others are paying their fair share of the collaboration tax. But it's also really important to minimize the collaboration tax. And so in order to make sure that you have time to execute and everyone around you has time to execute, you need to go through all these steps, but as quickly as possible. Don't get stuck on anyone. And everyone in an organization should be ruthless about killing unnecessary meetings. It's so easy for groups of people to just start wasting time. And then all your execution time happens when you're back at home late at night when you ought to be sleeping. And that's a disaster for everybody. So don't forget to kill as many meetings as possible. Be very conscious of killing unnecessary work. Very conscious of what you're not going to do, of saying no. That's how you have time to execute. And finally comes the most painful step of all. You've got to learn whether or not you made the right decision or executed well on it. You've got to look at the results and figure out, did it work? Did it not work? And be honest with yourself. And then you got to start the whole process all over again. That's why it's a wheel. You got to start listening. You got to start clarifying. And this is how you get stuff done collaboratively and in a way that's radically candid. This is sort of the alternative to command and control. I'm not saying that command and control can't work. It does work in some cases. It works especially well in a baboon troop or a totalitarian regime. But I don't think that's what you all at Lululemon are shooting for.
No, I hope not. From my point of view, that's not what I'm shooting for. No. So
doesn't seem like that from your culture or from your product.
I bet our new CEO, I don't think that's what he's aiming for.
No. Baboon troop, definitely not. Yeah. Probably not even a totalitarian.
Yeah. Well, thank you for walking us through those steps, Kim. I was thinking about, as you're talking, my own leadership opportunities and what steps where do I get tripped up? And I was thinking about persuasion and balancing emotion and logic and really kind of getting people on board with ideas. I'm curious if there's one step in particular that you notice managers or people leaders really get stuck on, and why would that be so difficult?
I think it's different for everybody. For me, I tend to really enjoy debate. I like debate, and so I'll spend too much time debating, and then I'll realize I'm spending too much time debating, and I'll just decide to make the debate end as opposed to being very conscious and intentional about why and when I'm. So that's kind of one of the things that I struggle with. But I met another leader who really struggled with the persuade part. This leader was very emotionally attached to the team and to the products that the team was building. I remember at one point he was trying to get his team to do something, and there was resistance, and he couldn't understand it. He said, "I couldn't be any more emotional." And I said to him, it's about their emotions, not your emotions. And then it was like this, and I said, "Why are they resistant?" He's like, "Well, they're burnt out and they're exhausted." I said, "Well, that's what you need to address, not your passion for getting this done, but the fact that they feel exhausted and burnt out." So I think it's different. I mean, some people love to admit when they're wrong, so the learning comes very easily. It's harder for other people. I think we all struggle. If you wanted to kind of stereotype, which I generally don't like to do, but like lawyers like the debate, generals like to decide, philosophers like to persuade, I mean, or salespeople like to persuade. So you can kind of joke around with it. And one of the things that is fun that I've done with some organizations is getting people to identify which of the modes they like the most. You know, are you a debater? Do you really like clarifying? Do you really just like listening? Are you a shrink? Do you just like listening? And then to get everybody to break into groups and tell each other what drives them crazy about getting stuck in that mode. And it can help a group of people work well together. I'll never forget, I was doing this with one group, and one of the people I worked with, when I explained why I like debate, said, "Oh, you're just trying to make this better. You're not trying to drive me crazy." It was like a real revelation for him when I explained why I like debate. He thought I was just trying to mess with him, I think.
Yeah, that's probably what my dad was doing. He's a lawyer all these years.
Yeah, now you know. See?
He's a natural debater.
Thanksgiving is going to be so much better now that you understand dad is just a debater.
Yeah.
There's so many fascinating insights from the book, and I just want to highlight one here. In a section called The Problem with Passion, you say, and I quote right from the book, "Your job as a leader, your job is not to provide purpose, but instead to get to know each of your direct reports well enough to understand how each derives meaning from their work." Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I think that cuts against the grain of certain assumptions in today's leadership zeitgeist.
Yes, I think you're right. And one of the things that has frustrated me often is at work, is when I'll have a boss who thinks that it's their job to be almost like a messiah. You know, that's not the boss's job. And to tell a whole team of people how they should feel about a particular thing or what the meaning of life is for them. And I think it's interesting. I think part of the misunderstanding comes from one of my favorite books of all time, Drive by Dan Pink. And he talks about the thing that gives work, that gets people excited about work, is autonomy, mastery, and meaning. And meaning is really important, but it doesn't mean that it needs to come. Meaning never comes extrinsic. Well, I shouldn't say never, but meaning usually comes intrinsically.
The whole book is designed around what intrinsic motivators.
Yeah, intrinsic. Yeah. And so it is not the CEO's job to tell people what gives them meaning. One of my favorite stories that gets used in a lot of different ways is about the architect who was rebuilding the cathedral after the Great Fire of London. And he walks around and he says to one person, "What are you doing?" And the guy says, "I'm laying bricks." And he says to the next worker, "What are you doing?" "I'm building a wall." And he says to the third worker, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm building a cathedral to the Almighty." And I think very often leaders think it's their job to like identify, "I'm building a cathedral to the Almighty." But the fact of the matter is, the first guy might have gotten a lot of satisfaction out of laying bricks. In fact, Plutarch wrote about how important bricklaying was to him, as well as philosophy. So it could be that bricklaying was what gave him meaning. And maybe that bricklayer, maybe he was an atheist. Maybe building a cathedral to the Almighty wouldn't have had any meaning for him at all. So you want to make sure that you're creating an environment in which people can build real relationships and can be who they really are at work. And if you're trying to tell people what gives their lives meaning, you're not allowing them to bring their whole selves to work, at least not in my experience.
And having those authentic relationships makes it so much easier to build a culture of feedback, right?
Yes.
In your book, you talk about, it's kind of almost two parts to culture of feedback. So there's criticism or calling out opportunities to do things
better. It's okay
better.
To call it criticism.
Yeah.
Like, I struggled with this when I was writing the book. I was like, it's criticism. Let's just admit it.
Yeah. And then there's praise, recognition, and both are important.
Both are really important.
Yeah. And my observations of Lululemon is that we are very, very good at being in mindful communication or real talk, as we kind of refer to it, around opportunities to be better. We definitely are, we're a culture of goal setters. We always strive for more. And what we hear on our employee pulse surveys is that we do have opportunity to be better at recognition. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what tips you have for, people managers to be really, really great at appreciating and recognizing their people.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the most effective things I ever did to build a culture of praise was to bring a stuffed animal to work. I bought this big stuffed killer whale to work. And in the team meeting, I said, "I want you all to nominate one another for great work. You've all done something exceptional this week. I haven't seen it all. Not everybody's seen it all. When you see someone else do something exceptional, I want you to nominate them for the stuffed killer whale. And people would stand up and start telling stories about stuff they had seen that was amazing that week. And it could have been an amazing work product. It could have been something really generous that one person did for another person. Could have been great teamwork. And it's really hard to give praise well. And I think part of the reason that it's hard is because you look smarter when you criticize someone, right? So you kind of take a little bit more risk when you offer praise. And so it's really important to get people to do it, to get, it's not a huge hump to get people over, but it is a little bit of a hump. It was interesting. I was talking to Andy Grove, who was the CEO of Intel a long time ago now, but he said that after he had been CEO for about a year, somebody snuck into his cubicle and nailed a big plaque to the wall that said, "Say something nice." And he realized he had not done nearly a good enough job of praising people in the organization. And he said part of the reason that praise was hard for him, and I think this is true for a lot of people, is that it's easy to come off as patronizing. Right? It's easy to come off as some kind of know-it-all or insincere. And I think part of the problem here is that a lot of people think of praise as the way you show care, that you care personally, and criticism is the way that you challenge directly. And that's incorrect. Praise should both show you care, but also challenge people to do more of what's great. And criticism should both show you care, but also challenge people to do better. So I think a couple of things can be helpful for managers who are struggling with praise. One is remember that a big part of your job is to paint a vision of what success looks like. I think you all have this. This is one of your core values, is vision. And criticism doesn't really paint a picture of what success does look like. It warns you that that's what it doesn't look like, and that's helpful. But it's praise that is your best tool to show people what success looks like, and stories around things that people did well. So you can add a couple of your sort of leadership principles is storytelling and vision. So just remember that. Like, if the purpose of praise is to show what success looks like, the purpose of criticism is to show what it doesn't look like. You should be giving more praise than criticism. Now, you don't want to try to manage your relationships through a ratio, because then you wind up saying things you don't mean, like, "Oh, I love your glasses. Your podcast sucks, but those shoes are awesome. By the way, this podcast is amazing." but you want to make sure that your praise has meaning. One of the leaders I worked with at Apple would ask a question when we taught managing at Apple, and her question was, "How much time do you spend preparing to criticize, like making sure you have the facts right, making sure you've got the story right?" And then she would ask, "How much time do you spend preparing to praise?" Again, making sure you have the facts right. And if you try to get a little bit more precise and maybe even nervous about giving praise, but recognizing it's important, and a little less about criticism, often you'll do a better job giving praise. So try that out. Does that help?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
The primary diagram in the book is a quadrant model. Of the four sections, of course, one is radical candor. Mm-hmm. You also have manipulative insincerity, mm-hmm. obnoxious aggression. Mm-hmm. I love the potency of the words. And the other one is ruinous empathy.
Yes.
Now, it's clear that aggression and insincerity are not qualities we want to perpetuate. Why and how can empathy be ruinous?
Yes, it is a really important question. One of the things that has happened to me throughout my life is that when I know how someone's going to feel, when I know something is going to hurt someone's feelings, I'm really reluctant to tell them that thing. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think most people feel that way. And sometimes I can get trapped by my empathy because I know in the short term it's going to hurt their feelings, but in the long term, they're better off knowing about it. And I think that that is one of the limitations of empathy, is that it tends to get us focused on a very short-term pain, and it can make it more difficult for us to do the thing that is kind in the long term. So it's funny, I thought about calling radical candor sort of compassionate candor or something like that. I think the word compassion can be a better word than empathy for getting us to focus on caring about the other person, but caring about the whole person and caring about the long-term impact that we're going to have on that person, not just the short-term impact. Does that make any sense?
Totally. And actually, our version of radical candor in the practice of leadership is straight talk and yes, has a long legacy here. And that really exists on a three-legged stool of commitment, curiosity, and compassion.
Yeah, compassion is such a great word. I mean, empathy, don't get me wrong. Empathy is usually a very good quality. But one of the things I wanted to help people see is that very often you think you're being nice, but you're not. And that's kind of why I called ruinous empathy, ruinous empathy. I'm not sure I got any of these words right, by the way. And one of the sort of weaknesses of strong language is that people often use the framework to judge others. They use it like some kind of Myers-Briggs test, and that's not what it is. So I beg of people, if you like the framework, don't use these terms as labels to hang around other people's neck, but use the framework to guide conversations that you're having to a good place.
Beautiful. And another little bit of the strong language that you use to describe some of your ideas in the book, which is on the cover of the book, is that this is about becoming a kick-ass boss without losing your humanity. And it's an incredible tool for people managers. And at Lululemon, we believe that everyone is a leader.
Yes.
And we chose this book for our core library because it supports that notion. So curious to hear from you, how can people who maybe aren't officially in management positions use some of the concepts in the book?
Well, you'll be glad to know we're about to issue a second edition, and it's the subtitle in the second edition is just Be Kick-Ass Without Losing Your Humanity. Because one of my favorite comments that I got from any reader was somebody wrote me and said, this is not a book about being a great boss. This is a book about how to be a good human being. So I believe, like you all do, that everyone is a leader. I wrote the book as a management book because I think that bad bosses create so much misery in the world that I wanted to really aim it at bosses. I thought that would give me the most leverage. But the truth is that if the idea of radical candor is you want to, first of all, solicit feedback, then you want to focus next on giving praise, focus on the good stuff before, and then giving criticism. And then you want to gauge how the other person is interpreting what you're saying. And then you also want to encourage between people. This is not about just about being a boss. This is true up, down, sideways. It's true at work. It's true at home. In fact, I wrote a whole novel about how I was using what I was learning at work to get out of a bad relationship and into a good one. So it'll work in all aspects of your life.
It's been amazing having Kim Scott, the author of Radical Candor, with us today. Thanks a lot, Kim. It's been a real treat.
Thank you all. It was really fun. It's great to be here in Vancouver.
What I'm going to take away with me, Kim, is I'm going to keep truth and love in my back pockets in all my conversations with everyone who I'm in relationship with here at Lululemon. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I love that.
And I trust you enjoyed and learned something today listening to this conversation. You've been listening to the Lululemon Speaker Series podcast. Until next time, I'm Juma.
And I'm Audrey. Thank you for joining us.